Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right.
Skylines is brought to you by 100 Resilient Cities. Pioneered by the Rockefeller Foundation, 100 Resilient Cities is helping cities around the world become more resilient to the physical, social, and economic challenges of the 21st century. You can find out more at 100resilientcities.org.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, a City Metric podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Stephanie, and this week we're talking about Christmas in cities, featuring a goat.
A park really does sort of offer cradle-to-grave facilities. You can go there as a child and play in a sandpit, and then you can go as you get older, you can play tennis or football with your friends, and then you get even older and you can go and sit in a walled garden, and then you die, and they put your name on a bench.
There's something about kind of like taking a train or a car journey, it just feels like you're cheating somehow.
It's Christmas! No, I totally clapped the levels. My Noddy Holder impression.
Can you do
is
it, but like further back?
I can't do a Noddy Holder impression.
Can you do Noddy Holder, but further away from the mic?
No, I mean, I literally can't do it. I tried and I've realised now I can't do that.
Tell me about the goat.
So, if you listen to the last episode, you'll know that I'm a huge fan of the Garvley goat, which is a giant straw goat erected every Christmas in the eastern Swedish city of Garvley, which people have historically had a pretty nasty habit of, you know, incinerating. This year's goat went up on November 29th, and it burnt down on November 29th. Within a matter of hours, it didn't even last the evening. It's a rather nice fire sound effect that Stephanie is helping us with right now by scrumpling up some plastic.
It's the lid of a can of San Pellegrino.
Are they sponsoring us now?
They are not, no.
We probably shouldn't.
But the corner shop
other
near
soft drinks are available.
The corner shop near our office does every single flavour of San Pellegrino, including the hard-to-find lemon and mint, so
I really hope we can get some money out of these people, because otherwise this has been a completely wasted amount. But yeah, the goat's gone.
The goat is gone.
The goat did not even last the hour.
John, I was so optimistic at the top of this podcast that we were going to make it really happy and about being outdoors and going for a walk, and you've already made it about Christmas dreams being literally burned to the ground.
I didn't make it. That is the good people of Garvley.
The goat arsonists.
Yeah. It's probably worth reflecting a bit more on the story of the Garvley goat, just because we talked about it briefly last week, but I just kind of want to read some extracts from the Wikipedia page for it, which is one of my favourite pages on the entire internet, and just lists the fate of every single Garvley goat. So,
go on, hit me.
1972, goat collapsed because of sabotage. 1974, burnt. 1976, hit by a car. 1978, again, the goat was kicked to pieces. 1979, the goat was burnt even before it was erected. A new one was built and fireproofed. It was destroyed and burnt into pieces. It goes on like this for like 30 years. They've been doing this since 1966, and every year something horrible happens to the goat. My favourite bit is in 1998, there is a major blizzard on the night of 11th December, and the volunteer guards go to get some coffee on the assumption that you can't burn a goat in a snowstorm. This assumption turns out to be wrong.
Is there any year where the goat did survive through to Christmas?
Oh, yeah. No, that happens loads.
Okay.
It's about half the time the goat makes it, but that's not a... I mean, if you imagine... Like, Manchester does its, like, giant Santas on the side of the town hall, right? If you imagine that 1 year in two, someone sets fire to the giant Santa on the side of the town hall, people would probably think that Manchester had a problem with Santa arson. So I'm not necessarily sure that, like, you know, the fact that half the goats survive is...
It's not a great survival rate for giant. No. I just wondered if you could do a kind of day-to-day style rundown where you go 1987.
No goat died.
Yeah. Happy Christmas, everyone.
Yeah.
So it is not the first day of Advent, but the first day of Atheist Advent, i.e. the first day of a tiny chocolate treat.
Yeah, slightly spoiling it, because we're recording this way in advance of releasing it, so it's going to be like the eighth day of Advent by the time we...
Okay, it is the eighth day of tiny chocolate treats. And how do you celebrate Christmas in the city in which we live, John?
Well, every year we go to Winter Wonderland.
Ooh.
On a Friday night.
Oh.
Which is hell.
I think we should explain for our international listeners, Winter Wonderland is...
It's basically a temporary theme park that goes up for 2 months in the middle of Hyde Park every Christmas, where you can buy overpriced hot booze and go on fairground rides and things like that.
I think kind of theme park is already overselling it, though. I think it's kind of like, imagine if there was an episode of The Apprentice where they had to design a German Christmas market for the MTV programme Jersey Shore.
That's okay, that's one way of putting it. There are a lot of... They have a lot of, like, giant statues with voiceovers in slightly offensive German accents. The whole thing is actually slightly racist against Germany, I think, which has not really been... But yeah, there's a giant... There's, like, a 30-foot wooden German with a 4-foot bird on his shoulder, and they sit there and they kind of talk to each other in this recorded German accent. It's not good. So, yeah, this is what we do for fun.
Wow.
It's one of those... Like, what it reminds me of, actually, is like about 10, 15 years ago, some of us went up to see a friend of ours, got incredibly drunk, and then went and got some stuff from a local kebab shop. And our friend passed out, and he was really grumpy and aggressive with us all evening. And the next morning, he said, "Oh, God, I didn't take you to the Pet King, did I?" What do you mean, the Pet King? It's always called the Kebab King, but we call it the Pet King because we think we're not sure of the provenance of all of the meat. We said, "So what? Why the hell did you take us there?" And he just went, "It's where we go."
Well, you're right. Winter Wonderland is... I don't go to it, but I find people kind of go... It may once have been optional whether or not I went here every year. It no longer is optional like this. I just go there.
Yeah, no one wants to be the person to say, can we do something else this year? There is actually an alternative one in Victoria Park, which is really... Have you been to that one?
I've not, no.
It's so half-hearted. It's like we go to that as well, and it's like, you know, they just come... You know, you get those stories in local newspapers this time of year about people who have taken their kids to see... So, like, some local Christmas theme park thing, and they get there, and, like, you know, Santa's got a fag hanging out of his mouth, and the reindeer are very clearly Alsatians with pretend antlers on, and, like, all the presents are, like, you know, Kinder eggs or something like that. It's basically that in the East End. So, Merry Christmas. What do you do for fun?
At Christmas?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think because I'm kind of... I still have to go home every Christmas because my mum's got kind of a three-line whip on her children being at home at Christmas. So I mostly drink snowballs. Have you had a snowball?
Is that the one with avocado in it?
It's avocado and lemonade.
I mean...
It's so good. It's vile, but it's brilliant.
It doesn't sound good. I mean, avocado is literally avocado-based, right? I mean...
No, it's egg.
Is it? Oh, I mean, yeah. Okay, that's just... It's not like egg and lemonade is something I've ever had dreams about, to be honest. So I've never been drinking a glass of lemonade and thought, need
more
egg.
It's kind of like custard liqueur with lemonade in it.
Okay, custard liqueur I can get behind.
Yeah, and they're delicious. They are, you know, an aberration, but really, really good. So I drink those, and then I do this thing where I'm the oldest of four. And there's a quite big gap, so I go from room to room trying to read a book and getting chased by my siblings who want to play and do nice things. Maybe I ruin Christmas, is what I'm...
You do sound like you need a visit from some ghosts.
Or goats. Or goat ghosts.
Ghost goats.
The ghost of burnt goats past. Okay, that took a weird turn, but you have actually spoken to people about having a good time in cities.
Not about Christmas, though. But yeah, this week we're going to talk to people about, you know, ways of enjoying the city. I mean, how do you enjoy a city when there isn't a goat to burn? First up, we're going to talk park life. No, don't do that. Just don't.
So my name's Peter Watts. I'm a writer and journalist based in London.
And you've been thinking a lot about parks recently.
I have been writing about parks and looking at parks and essentially the question of park funding, because parks throughout the UK are facing a sort of funding crisis at the moment.
Okay, first question: why do parks need funding?
Parks need funding because they need to be looked after. They need to be kept tidy and clean. Their facilities need to be painted and repaired and restored. And people discovered in the 1980s, when there was a similar parks funding crisis, that if parks were not looked after, not looked after, and people didn't use them, if people didn't use them, they became used for other activities, vandalism, prostitution, drug use, crime in general. And they become no-go areas, and they become a liability for the area in which they're based, rather than something that that makes the place better.
So it strikes me that parks are one of those things that everyone can see in the abstract, that a city with parks in it is going to be nicer than a city without parks. But it's quite difficult to translate that into a revenue stream. And we're sort of living in the age of austerity. So what can you do to kind of justify the spending on parks, I think?
Yeah, I mean, that is a real problem. I mean, the other problem is that parks aren't protected. I mean, a council doesn't have to spend anything on parks if it doesn't want to. And indeed, some councils actually want to reduce their spending on parks to zero. They want to make them completely self-financing. And there's a range of options for doing that. One of them is to use volunteers for a lot of the sort of basic repair and work, which is interesting, but puts a lot of pressure on quite often the sort of older members of the population. And then you can use it for events, which again has drawbacks, because you're often channeling off a part of the park that other people can't use. It can create a lot of damage. And what else can you do? You can put in more things like putting greens or tennis courts and raise revenue there. But you can also put in more commercial things, like in Battersea Park they've got a Go Apes thing, which is 30 odd quid a go, which is tree climbing.
And that's 30 quid to climb a tree.
Yeah, 30 quid to climb a tree. Very popular. It's the only one in central London. But, you know, that's an entirely privately run thing in a public park, which raises certain issues about what a park space should be for. But Battersea would say, well, Wandsworth would say, this helps us pay for our boating lake.
The word public in public park feels quite important here, because so many of Britain's great parks did come out of that period of sort of Victorian philanthropy of like wanting to build spaces, green spaces, that sort of newly industrialised populations could enjoy. It's the sort of lungs for the city thing, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And a lot of them were taken from stately homes as well, that no longer needed these huge expanses of green and land around them. They gave them or sold them at a cheap rate to the local council, to then turn them into parks. The idea being that this would keep the poor, the feckless poor, you know, out of taverns and out of gambling houses and out of brothels, and they'd go off for a walk around the park and improve their lungs. You know, that make them better workers. It would make them happier. There was also this idea that they would go off for a promenade in their Sunday best, and it would also stimulate the economy in times of a downturn, because people would want to look nice in the park.
But it feels like we've kind of lost that impulse towards providing public space for the sake of public good, and now it does keep coming back to this question of revenue streams and spaces having to justify their existence in some way.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult myth part, because people do recognise they are a public good. They're good for public health, they're good for public mental health, and they're good for house prices, which everyone seems to be able to understand what that means. But there is also the problem of, yeah, you know, a council can no longer just pay, you know, just pay as much as it wants for them. So it's a conflict, but I do think that at heart of it, people do want parks to remain public spaces as much as possible. So, for instance, although there has been some selling off of parks by councils that need money. There hasn't been a huge amount of that. You know, they're still trying to protect them, and they they do understand what they do and what they give us.
So if we're facing austerity budget, if you don't want to start selling tickets to Climatree for 30 quid a go, what can you do? Like, where else could you get money for these kind of things?
Well, the National Lottery, a big lottery fund, sort of did a big research project into this last year. It ran for about a year. Their concern was they had actually paid for a lot of park improvements from the 90s until into the 2000s. And they were really concerned that that investment was going to be wasted now because the local councils could no longer afford the upkeep. So they started to investigate and run various projects. A lot of it is simple fundraising, just trying to get people who go to the park to then just like donate some money. They want to have a subscription scheme so that everyone in the area of a park will pay, say, £10 a year. I mean, a lot of it is just basic fundraising. They tried this thing in Hoxton and Shoreditch and things where they built like a temporary office space for people to use. And, you know, you would book the office space and hire it and use it for events. This is like in squares, so it's trying to use the city squares for something. But that didn't really work because of vandalism. So they sort of explored various schemes. And the most successful have been kind of quite sort of mundane ones, I'm afraid. Things like just sort of changing how much you mow the grass and changing the sort of plants that you put out. So you don't have to have quite the same level of intense horticultural cultivation.
So much of this stuff sounds like we're just trying very hard to reinvent the wheel of, like, wouldn't it be great if everyone just put a little bit of money into the pot and that all went to the public? Oh, look, you've just invented tax. It just seems like we bend over backwards to not say maybe we should pay some tax for this public good.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, and that's exactly what these subscriptions are, that it's a very local tax. It's a voluntary tax, I suppose, just to make people feel a bit better about it. But, you know, with the proviso that if you don't pay the voluntary tax, then you might lose your park. So, yeah, completely. But, you know, for a council, they'll say, well, you know, we've got to spend money on this, that and the other. And, you know, we're not getting as much money now.
And councils are, there's all these horrifying projections that in like 10 or 20 years' time, at current rates of growth, council budget's going to be going entirely towards social care.
Yeah, exactly. And there is something positive out of it you could take out of it, which is that parks councils are having to think quite creatively because they want to keep parks. Therefore, they want to fund them. They're having to think of ways of keeping them alive without actually just simply, you know, just dipping into council revenues by actually raising money. So they're using the, I don't know, I think if you could see there's a positive there. They want to keep them another.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
I want to think of ways of making that happen.
Okay, let's kind of finish by moving away from the boring fiscal debate. Just tell me, what are your favourite parks? Give me a couple of examples.
Yeah, well, my favourite park is my local park, which is Brockwell Park in Brixton, Herne Hill. And what I like about a good park, I love Regent's Park as well, because I used to live around. I think, you know, we have personal attachments to parks that we have lived near because they're the ones we spent most of our time. And what I love about somewhere like Brockwell Park is that a park really does sort of offer like cradle to grave facilities. You can go there as a child and play in a sandpit, and then you can go as you get older, you can play tennis or football with your friends, you can climb trees, you can go BMXing, you can, then you get older and you can sort of, you know, take your kids to do all that, and then you get even older and you can go and sit in a walled garden, and then you die and they put your name on a bench.
City, you can just, you know, use your legs. Don't give me that look.
My name is Ed Jefferson. I write about things that no one else is interested in writing about, and Nicolas Cage mainly.
You've not done Nicolas Cage for us. You did do the Myers-Briggs test, all the different tube lines.
That was taking all the tweets that London Underground makes as the different tube lines and running them through an online analysis tool to determine their Myers-Briggs personality types, and it determined that the Waterloo and City line was the weirdest personality of all.
Yeah, it's the freak line.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think it might have had the same personality as Miley Cyrus and
I thought it was
Goebbels,
Taylor Swift. Okay, so you and I have something in common, which is we both like taking long, aimless walks, just, you know, miles and miles of, like, you know, the more industrial, the better, I find.
I think I'm sort of drawn, like, sort of magnetically or gravitationally. Like, the joke I always make is that kind of if I sort of walk at random within 2 to 3 hours, I will inevitably be in an industrial estate in the rain. Like, it's some sort of kind of powerful force drags me to sort of the sort of human misery of a closed industrial estate.
Yeah, I'm the same. And Sarah's always like, well, why don't you walk somewhere nice so that I can come with you? You know, somewhere with like shops and cafes. It's like, where's the fun in that?
Then you have to stop at the shops or cafes, which I do, even when I'm walking past sort of theoretically interesting things, I'm never really that interested in, like, it's things that I might visit if I happen to be staying in the place, but I need to walk. I need to do the miles.
Okay, the obvious question here is, like, we both do this slightly strange solitary thing, and I do know other people who do it as well. The obvious question is, what the hell's wrong with us? Why do we do this? Why do you do it?
There's an element of relaxation in terms of just sort of doing something quite, the sort of the active thing you're doing is not that difficult or complicated. So there's sort of lots of, then your brain can start sort of doing other things, and you can sort of kind of go to sort of strange abstract thought places. I think there's an element of that of just kind of, if you kind of find, realizing at the end of the day, you sort of figured some stuff out, even without really kind of even necessarily consciously thinking about stuff that hard.
Mm.
And the other thing I find is that in London, if I go for a long walk in London, there's this weird effect, because I've lived here for the best part of 15 years now, there's this sort of weird time travel effect where you sort of feel like you're crossing your own sort of time stream, and you kind of like go, oh, I remember when my friend used to live in that flat, or where that flat used to be if it's been demolished. And this weird kind of like, you pass some, like, on the same walk might take in two really important events in your life, but that were 5 years apart, but are somehow now linked geographically because you walk between them. So it's this sort of, I think there is sort of a weird, I mean, I don't know, they don't deliberately tend to set off unless I'm in a really maudlin mood to kind of like visit the lowest points of my life or anything.
Scenes of the crime,
but I think
yeah.
Eventually you sort of do pile up enough associations with the city that you kind of, at any given point between A and B, you probably will run into some bit of your past, which is.
See, with me, it started as a deliberate attempt to kind of tie the disparate elements of my life together. The first time I did a really long walk was an attempt to walk from where I was living in central London to my mum's house, which is in Romford, which is about 14, 15 miles out of town. And the first time I didn't make it because, frankly, I didn't make it because at the time I was in the middle of a master's degree, so I was still living like a student. So I thought, hey, I'll set off at like 2 p.m. in winter on this walk that's going to take me 5 or 6 hours. That can't possibly. And it got dark and I was halfway, so it's all this. But yeah, eventually I did that walk properly, and that was kind of the first time. So it was like a conscious attempt to sort of prove to myself that these two places were in the same city.
It's interesting. I've heard, I mean, typically, for obvious reasons, it's people who grew up not far from London or within London. Like, I've heard a couple of people who sometimes people who don't particularly walk that much, as far as I know, have done that thing of, like, walking from, like, yeah, their parents' house to where they live now. And it is, like, even, like, I grew up in Chichester on the south coast, which is probably two or three day walk, but it's definitely something that has this weird appeal, even though, like, I have no idea whether it's a particularly nice or interesting walk or whether it's a 75 mile long chain of industrial estates. But like, I think there is this sort of weird appeal of kind of like, yeah, linking parts of your own history, like on foot, like that you're something about kind of like taking a train or a car journey. It just feels like you're cheating somehow. It's like,
yeah,
you kind of just, you've skipped through and you haven't kind of seen what it actually feels like to move between these two places.
So what's a long walk for you?
Over 30 miles, I'd say, is like
bloody
long.
Hell. I'm actually, I think the longest I've ever done was like 21, 22. I got the train to Watford and walked back from there, which took me like basically a whole day last December. So like, yeah. I'm kind of in awe of doing 30. How do you even get through that many miles in one day?
I mean, usually the last five tend to be slower and involve more pubs, which has, I don't know whether it has some sort of like anesthetic effect on weary feet. But I think part of it's just built, like anything, you just build up tolerance to it. I really kind of like the sensation of having to spend a whole day kind of like walking, like it's kind of just stopping kind of like 3 in the afternoon, if you've set off early, just doesn't feel kind of like, you just feel like you can't do anything else your day because you're knackered anyway. So,
yeah. So, okay, I've got a problem with the long walks in that I kind of like to start from my house.
Yes.
Just because I don't like wasting time on trains or something. But the problem is I've kind of walked in every direction from my house, and it takes me probably about 90 minutes to get anywhere that's remotely new or interesting to me. And I'm finding it increasingly difficult to find somewhere to go. Because I like to walk with a purpose. I find, like, I can't just be like, right, I'm gonna wander, because then it's really difficult to kind of keep the stamina up when you start getting tired.
Yeah.
I've got to feel like I am going somewhere. Even though it's a completely made up concept of a journey in my head, I have to have some goal in mind to kind of keep me motivated by, you know, hour three or something. So where should I be walking? Where's good?
Well, I mean, the obvious way to get around that is to, if you like to go somewhere outside London, where you've booked everything, right? Because then you know you've got to get to Hotel X, but like by check-in time, and then the next day you've got to get to Station Y. Even if there's no particular reason to kind of be at either of those places, you then kind of, you put yourself in a position where it would be at least fairly expensive to suddenly abandon the endeavour. I've been spending a bit of time kind of walking bits of the south coast just because it's quite easily reachable from London. But also in partly because I've been thinking about this, like one day, and this is sort of quite a big if because of the amount of time and money involved, I'd quite like to walk around the entire coast of the British Isles, which will be easier soon because the English Coastal Trail, I believe, is going to be fully open by 2020, and there'll be a coastal path around the entirety of England, which will be signed and sort of properly funded. I mean, I found this website of a guy who's been doing it since about 1999 in bits. You think, well, that's fine, but it would be quite nice to somehow have the wherewithal to take 9 months off and just do it nonstop.
Is that how long it takes?
Something like that. Like, I think it does depend on, because you basically have to set up rules about like what you do when you go like at rivers, like do you so like do you walk, when you get to like the Thames estuary, do you have to walk all the way to the source of the Thames and back again? Or do you, like, what point you pick, like, what when's acceptable to get a ferry? And I think basically people, like, set up their own rules and kind of try and stick to them. And there's
I'm trying to think, that to do it on foot without using any mode of transport, you'd have to come all the way up to, like, Woolwich, wouldn't you? That's just, like, only, like, 8 miles from central London or something.
Is there a ferry at, like, Gravesend or somewhere?
Yeah, but that's cheating.
Yeah.
Woolwich, there's a foot tunnel, so you're still doing it. Whereas the ferry, you kind of, I mean, you might.
Well, I think there are places where you'd have to, you have to take a ferry or take like a very long detour. Some old guy's done it like 7 or 8 times, and kind of people are like slightly dispute whether they believe all the stories that he's told. It's a very select club of strange people.
Have you got like a favourite walk in London?
So there's a walking route in London called the Capital Ring.
Love the Capital Ring.
Which goes around sort of zone 3-4-ish. And the idea is that it forms a ring around the capital, as the name suggests. And you can indeed walk all the way because it goes over a bridge in Richmond. At the other side, it goes through the aforementioned Woolwich Foot Tunnel. But there's a section from Wimbledon Park that goes across Wimbledon Common and then through Richmond Park that's just really nice, especially sort of like in the evening if you like. Going through Richmond Park as the sun sets, it's like it really doesn't feel like you're in London. But then you sort of, either side of it, you very much definitely are. But, so it's quite good.
I redid the Capital Ring a couple of months ago, second time I've done it. And firstly, like, I made the mistake of, like, I kept doing evenings after work and I'd always sort of think I could do more than I could. So I got to the gates of Richmond Park and it's like, oh, it's going to close in 20 minutes, which is actually better than, like, I've been trying to work out, will I be in the middle of Wimbledon Common when it gets dark and will I therefore die? So actually not even starting that section that night was probably more sensible. But the other thing that really stays me about it is like, because it's mostly green sections. They kind of tie together a load of green sections wherever they can. And there's so many bits when you're on high ground and you look around and, like, you kind of can't see London. It's just, if you're on high ground, the highest things you tend to be able to see are, like, tower blocks and trees. So the number of places where you just look around and you're like, it doesn't look like there's a city there. It looks like there's a bunch of trees with the occasional building poking out.
I actually did in one day the entire southern section, basically as a sort of to see if I could, because it's about 36 miles or something. Walk through all these green spaces that have been connected as part of this route 10, 15 years ago, maybe? I can't remember exact. And it's sort of interesting, they do sort of represent kind of the disparate history of green spaces in London. For City Metric, I wrote about Wandsworth Common and its weird history of electing fake mayors to stop the Earl Spencer from selling off bits of the land. And it's sort of some of the green, there are lots of examples of kind of bits of green space where they're preserved because people needed to use them to graze cattle and kind of protested when their owners wanted to sell them off. But there are other examples where it's almost the opposite, where it was the grounds of the manor house and were there precisely so that the rich owner could see something nice outside his house. And then there are bits that are kind of were originally industrial because you've got bits that go along canals, or there's a section that follows the New River, which is built to bring drinking water in. It's sort of all these kind of things that once existed for very different reasons have been combined into this kind of like.
There's next railway line as well, isn't there? It's the Northern
that's
Finsbury Park up to Highgate.
Yeah, that's where it runs right by my house. It's also interesting to think, like, when you think that a lot of this stuff wasn't. Like, it is relatively new. It's only been relatively recently open as a kind of like public space. Like, that railway line was been in the 80s, I think it was, because it had been dormant since the
30s. Because it was originally an overground line, and they took up the tracks, and they were going to turn it into part of the tube network, but then Hitler happened.
Yeah.
And they just never got around to it, so it was just sat there.
Yeah, and I get like the New River, which runs up through the Lee Valley, and it's still, I think, part of the London's water supply. But even that was only a relatively recent phenomenon that you've been able to kind of walk the length of it. And reading the history of the Capital Ring actually is quite interesting about how it was put together. There was a lot of thinking about how sections should be useful. So they might be kind of like kind of walks that people would do as part of a commute. And there's some of it, like, for the sort of different reasons for that, like, partly that was like, well, okay, if we want to make this sort of a place that people want to come to, we don't want it to be some desolate area where only people who are going to do this capital ring thing are going to, because it'll be, might be a bit intimidating and frightening. So can we actually make this useful, like, for people who want to walk somewhere for a reason, as opposed to lunatics like us who just want to walk around the capital ring because it's there, like.
I've done that twice. Yeah, in the same direction both times.
But yeah, I don't like the idea of doing it the wrong way around. It's,
which way around do you go?
The numbered order from Woolwich to...
you're wrong. You're doing it wrong.
That's the official order, as it says.
I know, but I don't play by the rules.
But you don't want to be walking away from the river at Richmond Park, because you end up in a really rubbish bit of Wimbledon.
I know, I've done it twice.
This is a Brooklyn-bound A express train. The next stop is Dyckman Street. This is a 125th Street-bound A express train. The next stop is 59th Street, Columbus Circle.
Okay, so we have talked about Christmas being miserable and talked about fun that's not Christmassy. Is there any way we can talk about Christmas fun?
We could just put them up as Christmas Carol on.
I feel like putting the whole of the Muppets Christmas Carol inside a podcast might be some kind of copyright violation.
Also, it'd be quite a big file to download, so...
How about, John, we just talk to the people of Twitter who we asked a question?
Well, we could do that part, yeah, okay. So, this week, in keeping with our theme, we asked people their favourite Christmas traditions and which city they would like to spend Christmas in.
A lot of these were either oddly miserable or very general, along the lines of I drink, get home late and wrap presents while drunk, which you can do in any city or indeed outside of cities.
You don't even need Christmas, to be honest. I mean, if you just wanted to come home pissed and wrap presents, that is a thing you could do. I mean, you could ruin a partner's birthday that way.
Could ruin an anniversary.
Yeah.
I mean, christening.
There's so many things you could ruin.
Ollie Lee, who's in Norwich, writes in with both a nice thing and the thing that's about Christmas. So well done, Ollie. He tells us that Norwich's Tunnel of Light is proving popular. It's the first year, so it's not a tradition, but it does look beautiful.
Yeah, it's a very pretty picture. We'll stick that in the show notes. I like this one from Jim Waterson at BuzzFeed, because we always used to go for a walk along the railway tracks on Boxing Day, and there's no trains. Hang on, that's illegal, right?
That's Jim Waterson at BuzzFeed, if you're listening from the constabulary.
Yeah, he's very easy to find. He's the guy who likes the trains. Talking of things that are illegal...
Yes, somebody who will not be named writes in and says, every Christmas, me and old school friends pub crawl in Pompeii. Someone says, it's a white Christmas, let it snow, and go to the toilet with key.
I love the fact it's like, how do you celebrate Christmas? Well, I take some drugs.
Louise O'Connor from Dublin says, the Wren in Dingle and Dublin, a bunch of old lads cover themselves in straw and sing songs for money. Have I ever told you about the time I was in Cornwall a few days before Christmas and went into the pub The Famous Barrel in Penryn Old Fishing Harbour Village and found it full of mummers who had been mumming?
What? Explain for the listeners rather than for me, because I obviously know what a mummer is, but for the benefit of the listeners, explain what a mummer is.
They're kind of travelling bardic people who put on skits.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
The idea is they travel around and they act out scenes and do dances, and it's kind of a very old English, slightly pagan, creepy thing.
Yeah.
And I went into this pub in Cornwall and there were just loads of huge Geordies in face paint, and they stayed until like 2 a.m. playing music. It was quite nice.
Yeah. I'm from Essex. We don't really have mumming in Essex.
No, you don't have mumming in Essex.
No.
You have Winter Wonderland and doing drugs in the toilet.
Yeah. Our colleague Anna said she really likes it when tube staff give out chocolates and mince pies.
I've never seen that.
I think maybe people are just like going around handing Anna sweets.
Yeah, you have to... Anna is like a really nice-looking, good person. If you run into her, do you give her chocolates and mince pies?
Although, actually, a Christmas tradition I really like round here is the Christmas sandwich roundup, in which we shamelessly encourage various purveyors of bread products to send us free sandwiches so we can review them.
Coming up soon from our colleague Anoush, the Christmas sandwich roundup 2016. Marxist Loser, whose username is followed by three despairing faces, said... I don't know if this counts, but when I'm in Rio, I like to check the huge, ugly Christmas tree they have by the lagoon. I've never seen that, but I'm going to go Google it straight after this.
Okay, I have an issue with Christmas in the Southern Hemisphere because it just seems off to me. Like, but also all the imagery is off. So we had a piece a couple of years ago about Christmas in Buenos Aires by a writer called Drew Reed, and it was basically about their local equivalent of Winter Wonderland, and it had all the same sort of Christmas imagery. It's all like, you know, the fir trees with fake snow on, but it's 30 degree heat because it's the middle of summer. So like, even though Christmas happens in summer down there, the imagery still pretends it's winter, and that's weird.
No, I heard about this because my flatmate, or my ex-flatmate before he foolishly fell in love and left my lovely flat in East London, said the same thing. Said that they spray fake snow on their windows. She lived in a beach house in Australia. But I kind of like that because I feel it can be inspirational to us as we, and going back to last week's theme, deal with the new world in which the Arctic has melted.
Happy Christmas, everyone. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by me, John Allidge, and by Stephanie Boland, and was produced by Royfield Brown. You can contact all three of us on Twitter, and there's a very good chance we'll reply. All music in the show is produced by Noah Tilson Brown. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast or on iTunes. In the meantime, check out our website, citymetric.com, where we post news stories every weekday. And, you know, since you're still here, why not leave us a nice review on iTunes? Go on, I'll be your friend. Thanks for listening.
This station.